Welcome to Sacred Realms. What? It's a great day in Hyrule, y'all. Welcome to Sacred Realms, a Zelda retrospective podcast. I am your host, Lyndon Willoughby, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Matt Willoughby. How are you doing tonight, Matt?
Lyndon, I am great. It is a beautiful Sunday here in Texas, and we have a citizen of my second favorite country in the world to join us today, a wonderful Australian gentleman. And I can't tell you, I've never been to Australia. I've met many Australians in the places I've been, and I've loved every single one of them. So I'm excited not only to talk about some Zelda, but to talk about Zelda with someone with such an amazing accent.
I would love to go to Australia with you someday, Matt.
I mean, eventually. We'll have to make our way down there.
For the scuba diving, if nothing else.
Oh, for sure. I mean, although I hear... I mean, I don't want to get off on too much of a tangent, but the Great Barrier Reef, while one of the great wonders of the world, I've heard has diminished somewhat in the recent years, but we definitely need to go check it out.
Yeah, turns out people mess things up just a little bit. Who knew?
And Cody, are the spiders down there as really as terrifying as I've heard? Because I hate spiders.
They're not as terrifying as in the video game Ocarina of Time.
Well, that's okay. Well, that's fair. We're not seeing any Queen Gomas running around down there.
Yeah, or gold sculptures. No Queen Gomas that drop their eggs from the ceiling and hatch little spiders.
That's definitely good. I'm glad to know that. I don't need to bring my kokiri sword or slingshot. So that's good.
I'm glad. Look, however big the spiders are in Australia, I'm glad they're not the size of a small child, at least. So. Cool. Okay, so as Matt mentioned, we do have another guest on the podcast today. Last guest we had was the amazing Kylie Parker, Dangerous Pixels. Today, we have got Cody Davies of Zelda Universe. Cody, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
We're really glad to hear that. So, Cody... I feel like anybody who's been in fan circles, in Zelda fan circles online, for any appreciable amount of time is familiar with Zelda Universe. But, you know, for anybody who isn't, or for anybody who might not know who you are specifically, tell us more about you, what you do for Zelda Universe, what Zelda Universe is. Give us the whole thing.
Sure. So Zelda Universe has been around for 20 years now. Started up in 2001, which is very... In internet years, that's very long.
Yes.
It's only a few fan sites still around that are older than a few Zelda fan sites still around that are older than Zelda Universe, and they're not necessarily active. They're just, you know, still up. Whereas Zelda Universe has had a thriving, you know, forum community since I joined the forums in 2003. So my forum account is going to turn 18 in a few months, so it's older than some of the volunteers on the site at this point. So it's been going a while, but yeah, I joined the forums in 2003. Then I joined the staff in 2007. I'm in charge of the media side of things, so we have, you know, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, Twitch. We have a TikTok now just to keep up with the kids these days. and we do various things like that. So that's sort of the area of it that I'm focused on at the moment. But yeah, you can go to ZeldaUniverse.net and there's lots of stuff going on.
The fact that 2001 was 20 years ago just baffles me. When you said like, oh, it's 20 years old, I was like, oh man, it must have been founded in like the 90s. And he's like, yeah, 2001. I was like, oh my god, I'm getting old.
You know what's coming up next on its 20th anniversary is the Wind Waker. So
oh my god,
you are old. Just wanted to put that out there. Yeah, I think
we're all getting there, right?
And how old is Ocarina of Time?
1998. I mean, what is that? Like, that's going on 25 years, right?
I mean,
I don't math well.
23. 23. So, it's 5 years younger than I am, and I'm turning 28 this year. So there you go.
Man.
Good
but
God.
That's what's interesting about Zelda community to me is that because the people who were five when The Legend of Zelda came out in 1986, you know, are, what's up, I think 39 or something like that at this point. Mm-hmm. And the people who were five when Breath of the Wild came out in 2017 9. So there's a...
Oh my God, that's almost more scary than anything else you've said.
The generational bridge there that I guess we can all say Zelda bridges a lot of generational gaps for sure. Like, wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And it's basically every generation of, you know, rather than Gen X, Gen Y, it's more like console generations because the people who started with the Super Nintendo and the people who started with the Nintendo 64 have, you know, very different opinions on the Zelda, you know, what the Zelda series means and that sort of thing. So,
yeah. Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, and a good example of that is, and Matt and I have kind of listed our histories with Zelda out on this podcast before, but Ocarina of Time was very much my first big Zelda game. I played Link's Awakening before that and enjoyed it, but wouldn't have considered myself a Zelda fan necessarily. And then Ocarina of Time came out and I was hooked forever. But I didn't go back and replay A Link to the Past until I was much older. I mean, late high school, college, something like that. It was a very long time. But that game, it's not like that game came out that much before Ocarina of Time. The amount of time between those games is not very long. It's certainly much shorter than the gap of time between, say, Skyward Sword and Breath of the Wild, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, or it might be equal. Skyward Sword was 2011, Breath of the Wild is 2017, 6 years. So Link to the Past is what, 1990? To Ocarina of Time,
1990, 1991. So, about the same sort of gap.
Yeah, roughly equivalent, but like that small amount of time is. You know, can feel infinite to somebody of a certain age who picked up gaming at a certain point with a certain console, you know?
It was released in 1992 in North America, by the way.
Yeah, the release schedules for the earlier Zelda games were kind of weird from Japan to America, though. I think starting with
91 in Japan, 92 in A Link to the Past.
Yeah, I think starting with Ocarina of Time, our release dates were pretty much synced up, but before that, it's a little squirrely.
But. Yeah, well, it used to be a whole different situation with releases. You would see in the magazine or whatever they're covering some game, and they're like, hopefully it gets translated into English, you know.
So we did this with Kylie. I guess we'll ask Cody here the same question. What Zelda games have you played? And then what is your favorite? And if you're feeling brave, what is your least favorite of the ones that you have played?
All right. So
Cody cracks his knuckles as he prepares to tell us which Zelda games he's played.
He's going
to
school us novices, Lyndon. You called me a novice in the intro episode. And both get to be novices.
I've played Zelda games that haven't even been released in North America.
Wow. Okay.
Because the Tingle series didn't get released in North America.
Yeah,
that's fair.
So, you know, but it makes it sound very impressive. So it did get released in Europe. So Australia did get it because they followed generally the Europe release. But yeah, look, I've played all of them. I haven't necessarily finished all of them. There's a few that... Mostly the multiplayer ones I have less experience with, because you need friends. Yeah, well, you need local friends that all have Game Boy Advances or whatever, and you connect it with a cable. For me, I started with Ocarina of Time, and sort of went back and played the older ones after that. And so I sort of do have a bit of a bias towards the later era, I guess. Like, a lot of people have nostalgia for, you know, the original or A Link to the Past, whereas for me, you know, those are I see those as important, but I don't necessarily see them as in my personal, you know, top five list. For me, my top list would be, so Breath of the Wild, really, really impressed me. Then we've got Majora's Mask and Wind Waker, which are games that, what those three have in common is that I think they're the more open, world, heavy side questing kind of games where you can just ignore the main quest and just veer off and just sail off to an island and do something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I really enjoy that kind of thing. I'm the sort of person who has put like 400 hours into Skyrim and I've never finished the main quest line.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. It's the Skyrim main quest is lackluster.
Right. You know, but I was just, you know, it's the same for everything. I'm like, main quest, you can't make me make the story go forward.
You can't make me beat the game. Yeah.
So as you could tell, Breath of the Wild is perfect for me then, because there's several hundred hours of things to do that, I actually spent about 100 hours before I did my first dungeon. And then, I sort of did the prerequisite stuff for the dungeons. I was wandering around, but I just didn't finish the dungeon until I saw someone being like, oh, you get to like fly and stuff. Up in the air when you finish this, you know, bird dungeon. And I was like, oh, that actually sounds useful. I guess I should finish the dungeons.
well, that's fair, yeah. Also, but Urbosa's Fury is just OP.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. No, they're all very nice. So those would be my top. Then Ocarina of Time probably in number four. And then maybe A Link Between Worlds, which is my favorite of the handheld ones. So
interesting.
Yeah. And then favorite, Zelda 2 is the obvious pick, but I don't dislike it so much as just I find it hard to get into because I wasn't from that generation. I just think NES games in general have a sort of difficulty that's, you know, there's sort of an artificial difficulty to NES games that are like, we need to hide the fact that our game is 3 hours long, so we're going to make it very difficult.
Yeah, definitely. I think, so Matthew and I both, we have committed to playing the NES Zelda games, and we're both kind of living in fear of that decision, just because neither of us have, and I think we're both anticipating the difficulty and like kind of the obtuse design of those games being a very frustrating thing to overcome. And so I'm sure it'll be fun in its own way, but game design has come a long way since The Legend of Zelda and Zelda 2. So
as someone whose only NES game has ever been Mario and Donkey Kong, I kind of am dreading that. Although I did play about 15 minutes of the Return of the Jedi SNES game.
Oh, those are good.
And never even made it past Jabba's Palace because it's legitimately impossible.
Well, so those were some of my, those Super Star Wars games were some of my first video games that I ever played on my uncle's Super Nintendo. And like, I've always thought it was so funny. I mean, talk about a different era of game design. I mean, those games are brutally hard. They don't line up with the movies really at all. Like, there's some wild crap that happens in those games that's just not even like in the movies, you know, a scene that takes 2 minutes is like in the game, it ends up being Chewie fighting like a giant octopus or something, you know, and it's weird. It's like, what? How did we get? I don't feel like this happened in the movie ever. But, you know, video games were very much coming into their own at that time.
Mm. Yeah, I think. For me, the NES is a little too early for me. The Super Nintendo is, I think, just a very solid console, especially if you like Japanese RPGs and that's, you know, things like Chrono Trigger and Earthbound and Final Fantasy,
Secret of Mana,
you know. But as far as NES recommendations, Super Mario Brothers 3 is I think one of my favorite Super Mario games. But in terms of Zelda, I think it's something that you'll just have to go. You might have to go to ZeldaUniverse.net and look at some guides sometimes.
I will be heavily relying on some Zelda Universe guides for those two games.
Yeah,
good
plug, by the way. And also, we will use it because I feel like we're gonna be crying for mercy at some point.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, I'm gonna make a confession here to both of you and our listeners. I actually had to use a guide in the Forest Temple this time.
Seriously?
I got stuck for like an hour, and the solution was so simple that I literally kicked myself when I literally looked it up and it was like, don't do this before you do this.
All right, guys, we're gonna add a supplementary section to the Sacred Realms rundown this week titled Where Did Matthew Have to Use the Guide?
It's Matthew's shaming hour.
Okay.
And I'm voluntarily telling you about it, Lyndon and Cody, and listeners.
Don't worry. When I first played Ocarina of Time, well, I was 8, so I have more of an excuse, but...
yeah, it's not your 6th time playing it and still getting kind of screwed up, yeah.
I did get stuck in this upcoming section with Epona where... You get locked in and he's like, oh, you can't leave. And I was like, oh.
Oh, that's totally fair. There's absolutely no way in the world anyone could figure that part out without just like riding around willy-nilly.
Yeah.
So that's fair.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, we're going to get into all that here in just a minute. In the meantime, we're going to get into some housekeeping. If you guys didn't know, Sacred Realms is a weekly re-examination of The Legend of Zelda one little slice at a time. Sacred Realms drops every Wednesday and is available on all major podcast networks. Every week, we play a new section of a Zelda game, and then we sit down here to talk, to drop our hot takes, let you guys know what we're feeling. If that sounds at all fun to you, please head over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Hit that like button, hit that subscribe button, give us 5 stars, whatever options they give you. Please leave us a review. If you have a chance to write one, we really appreciate that. Those reviews go a long way and help us get in front of people who might not otherwise see the podcast. As just a quick reminder, we are currently going through our poster giveaway contest. If you go to our Instagram, which is at Sacred Realms Pod, you'll see a picture of some Zelda screen printed posters designed by yours truly. We are offering those to our fans in the form of a contest at the moment. All you have to do to get a chance to win those is to follow us on Instagram at Sacred Realms Pod and leave us a review on your podcast network of choice. Take screenshots of you doing that and email it to us at sacredrealmspod@gmail.com. And then the window for that is going to close by next Wednesday when the Fire Temple episode airs. We'll close that down and we'll pick from whoever has submitted up until that point. So we've already gotten a lot of great feedback on that. A lot of you have left us some great reviews and we appreciate that so much. Please, please keep it up.
By the way, that date is May 12th, if anyone is trying to mark it on their calendar. Okay. May 12th is the closing of the poster giveaway.
So here we go. 11:59 p.m. on May the 11th. That's your cutoff point.
There you go.
Basically midnight that day.
Central time.
Central time. We are in Texas. That is CDT, Central Daylight Time at the moment. So anywho, get those in there and we will get those posters out to somebody. Can't wait to see who gets it. If you would like a little more Sacred Realms in your life, you can head on over to patreon.com/sacredrealmspod. There you can get access to bonus episodes. You can write in listener mail. You can vote on what game we play next and much more. I would like to remind everybody that we are in the back half of Ocarina of Time at this point. And so here in the,
we've got 4 more dungeons.
I mean, we're...
So we're at the halfway point, basically.
Okay. Before too long, we're going to have to figure out which game we're playing next, and we're going to rely on our patrons to decide that for us.
That's
so
true.
Here in the next few weeks, we're going to put a poll up on the Patreon page where you can vote on what we play next. It is going to be a top-down game. We decided up front we're going to go 3D to top-down and back and forth and back and forth. So it is going to be a top-down game. So anyway, that'll go up soon. Regardless, please head over there. And if you want to vote in that poll, that's where you will be able to do it. But without further ado, Matt, Cody, let's talk about what we played. This is the Sacred Realms Rundown, which is a six-part analysis of what we played this week and the feelings that it made us feel. Today, we're covering Ocarina of Time Chapter 4, which is going to take us from opening the Temple of Time through beating the Forest Temple. And to be quite frank, this is a chunky section.
C-H-O-N-K. With three Y's.
Yeah, it's beefy. So we got a lot to get into. As always with the Sacred Realms Rundown, part one is going to be the plot recap as read by Matt. He's getting real good at it at this point, so we're going to let him do it.
Well, I better be good at it at this point because today's is the longest by far.
It is so many pages.
It's five-ish pages.
I mean, this is a narratively speaking, this is a section of the game that is pretty pivotal. I mean, we learn a lot. We have a paradigm shift in the entire setting of the game. We get a lot of exposition, a lot of cool stuff. So
more story dump, lots of story dump,
a lot of story dump. So I would say, with the exception of maybe the end of the game, this is probably the most narrative heavy part that we're going to have.
Agreed.
Yeah.
And I know you and I have been talking a lot, so I'm going to do a little bit of monologuing here, and then we're going to make sure that Cody has his say, because he's being a little quiet over there in Australia.
Cody and I can talk later, but...
This is my time to shine.
An inviolable rule of the Sacred Realms Rundown is that Matthew has the floor for the plot recap.
Yes. It's my favorite part every week.
I hate that we've given you so much power.
This is your fault.
We've committed to it. So
we're already four episodes in. We just got to keep rolling with it, right?
Uh-huh. Let's do it.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to story time. I'm so excited.
Just read it.
Fine.
Just
all right, here we go. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we finally have all of the spiritual stones needed to open the Temple of Time and help Zelda protect the Sacred Realm and the Triforce within. It's now finally time for us to meet up with the Princess of Destiny and fulfill our promise. As we head back to the castle, the thunderheads on the horizon grow and grow. Upon reaching the drawbridge surrounding Castle Town, we catch a brief glimpse of a white horse laden with two riders pelting down the street before they almost run us over. As the horse flies by, we see Impa, and to our shock, Princess Zelda fleeing south as quick as the wind. Zelda seems to throw something from the back of the horse that lands in the moat, but we have no time to contemplate this as another horse and rider come upon us.
It's a good throw, by the way.
It was seriously NFL really good throw. Quarterback throw. It was amazing.
Yeah.
There before us is a gigantic black horse and its rider in full black armor. Ganondorf himself sits before us, obviously pursuing the princess and her attendant. In a booming voice, the traitorous Ganondorf questions us as to which way the princess went, but our answer is simple and swift. A drawn blade is preferable to betraying the princess. With a laugh of contempt and condescending remarks about our stature, Ganondorf swats us aside with a burst of magic as if we were no more than a fly. With one last cutting remark, he pursues the princess into the distance. Now that our adversary has apparently abandoned the city, it's time to protect the Sacred Realm and hopefully allow the princess to return safely to the castle once we have fulfilled our duty. But first, what did Zelda throw to us from horseback as if she were Tom Brady? We find the mythical Ocarina of Time, once the treasure of the Hyrule family. As we pick it up, a flood of memory comes our way to show us Zelda in front of the doors of time to give us the final key to opening the doors to the Sacred Realm, the Song of Time itself. Entering the temple, the marvelous marble floors, vaulted ceilings, and stained glass window all pale in comparison to the massive stone doors sitting at the opposite end of the cathedral. As we approach the pedestal, we follow Zelda's instructions and play the Song of Time on the ocarina in order to open the doors. The spiritual stones are magically drawn to their respective places on the pedestal, and the doors rumble open on unseen hinges, and we step through to confront our destiny.
Man, would you like to pursue a career in audiobooks?
I mean, I wouldn't be opposed.
Okay, cool.
Cody, are you as captivated by this as I am by myself? Because I feel like I'm doing a pretty good job here.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You don't have to say yes to him. It's okay.
Please say yes.
All right, go.
That's amazing.
Going.
All right, so it's like my very own audiobook of Ocarina of Time.
Yes, that's exactly what I wanted to hear. Oh, this is amazing.
Oh man, he's not going to shut up about this for weeks.
No,
okay.
Not at all. Navi sees something that takes her very small.
Navi, can we break you
I
of
told
this,
you,
please?
I told you the very first week we started this game, I am going to call her Navi because I have called her Navi my entire life.
But people are talking about it in reviews now, like you're saying it wrong. Okay, go.
Navi sees something that takes her small breath away. A sword thrust into a stone, resplendent in a beam of pure light. This is not just any sword. This is the Master Sword. The sword that only the Chosen One can wield, a sword of unimaginable and pure power, whose very purpose is to drive away the powers of darkness. Drawn to this blade, we approach the pedestal with reverence, and without even thinking, we grip the hilt and draw the sword from the stone. Bright light floods the entire chamber. Power surges through the floor, through the sword, and throughout our body, but something is very wrong. A condescending and triumphant chuckle reverberates throughout the Cathedral of the Sword. Ganondorf, it appears, did not pursue the princess, but instead... has been stalking us, knowing that it was our plan to safeguard the sacred realm by opening the doors. In our haste to protect the Triforce, we have unwittingly given it directly to the man we were attempting to keep it from. Nothingness, white light, an odd voice calling through the haze. Link, wake up. We come to in a place unlike any we have ever seen, a chamber of what appears to be water and empty space. Waterfalls with no source are suspended around the chamber and floating in midair. And in front of us is an old man we have never seen before. He appears ancient and wise. As we come to our senses, he explains that he is Raru, the Sage of Light, and that he has taken us to the Chamber of the Sages, deep within the heart of the Sacred Realm. 7 years have passed since we drew the Master Sword from the pedestal, and in that time, Ganondorf has conquered the entire world with his evil magic, turning Hyrule into a land of horror and monsters. Raru has sequestered us in the Chamber of Sages because, just as the Deku Tree hinted, we are the chosen savior of Hyrule, whose destiny is to save the land from the evil king. But as we could not fulfill that destiny. He has kept us here to allow us to grow into the hero that the world needs. Looking at ourselves, we see, to our surprise, that we are now a grown man. The Deku Shield, the Kokiri Sword, and all of our tools were just not cut out for the job at hand. Now we will wield the sacred blade against the minions of darkness. Raru charges us with a monumental task, to set out and save the 5 remaining sages and claim their powers so that we can free the land from the curse and defeat Ganondorf. He gives us the Medallion of Light and sends us back to the land of Hyrule to begin our quest. As we re-enter the sword room, a strange figure calling themselves Sheik tells us that they have been waiting for us for a very long time. They point us in the direction of the best place to start our quest, the sacred forest meadow that we know so well from our childhood. We leave the temple to discover exactly what Raru had warned us about, an apocalyptic hellscape in what was once the bustling heart of Hyrule. Following Sheik's last piece of advice, we revisit Kakariko Village and find that all the survivors of Castletown have relocated here. After receiving the hookshot from the dead gravedigger Dompe, we head to the home that we knew in our childhood. Kokiri Forest is just as infested as the rest of Hyrule, and the citizens of the village live indoors in fear of the monsters that have invaded their village, not unlike those of us during the time of COVID-19. After convincing Mido that we are here to save Saria, we make our way past an army of monsters and moblins to the ancient forest temple in search of our dear friend Saria. Instead, we find Sheik once more, who teaches us the mystical minuet of forests and tells us that we need to enter the temple and lift the curse placed on this forest by defeating the dark forces within. The temple is indeed not only infested with monsters, but also haunted by evil spirits. As we progress through the temple, cleansing it of monsters and ghosts alike, we find four ghostly sisters who are the primary source of the temple's woes. Using our new bow, we defeat the ghostly sisters and open the way to the very bottom of the temple and the final source of the dark power within. In the final room, we are confronted by what at first appears to be Ganondorf himself, only for the apparition to remove its own face as if it were a mask and reveal itself to be a powerful specter from beyond our world. Using our tools and our courage, we exorcise the demon and purify the temple, and we are drawn back into the Chamber of the Sages, where we are greeted by none other than our dearest friend Saria, who reveals herself to be the Sage of the Forest. She grants us the Medallion of the Forest and promises that we will be friends forever before sending us back to the Grove of the Deku Tree. Finally, with the curse of the Forest Temple lifted, life begins to return to a semblance of normalcy within the forest. This is most strongly shown by the sprouting of the Deku Sprout, who will one day grow to replace the Great Deku Tree as the Guardian of the Forest. The Sprout gives us the final piece of the puzzle to our own destiny, telling us the story of how Link's mother brought us here to the forest as a child and entrusted us to the Great Deku Tree, because she knew that our destiny was to be a great one. With this final knowledge of our lineage clicked into place, we are set once again along the path to save Hyrule. And now I need a drink of water because, wow, that was a monologue.
Ladies and gentlemen, that has been the plot recap as read by Matt. That was a lot. I mean, man, that is some story right there. Before we move on, I just want to say that I'm going to try real hard to source an MP3 of Ace Ventura talking about exorcising the demons.
I have exorcised the demons.
I really hoped you would.
Yeah, well, for me, when you mentioned the Minions of Darkness, I was just thinking about Minions.
Despicable Me?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's just the Forest Temple, you know? You're kicking those guys up one side and down the other, right?
The little yellow dudes with one like, eye. Being like the Wind Waker with the little mini blends going, na-nat, 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 except they're Minions.
Yeah. Okay. So, as we've said before, Matthew has not played Wind Waker. I have. So when
that joke is lost on me,
I get the joke. Whenever Matt gets around to it, we're gonna circle back to this conversation.
Okay.
And yeah, we'll get there.
I mean, I just love the mental image of minions running around in The Legend of Zelda in general. So appreciate at least half the joke
instead of like the giant Deku Baba coming out of the ground.
It's just like a giant yellow minion. Yes, love it. Perfect.
I'd still hit him with my sword every time.
Well, obviously.
Okay, part two is going to be our takes talking about what we thought of this whole section. Cody, I want to talk to you a little bit about what this section of the game means for both this game, but also Zelda and even video games in general, because my personal opinion is that the moment that you exit the Temple of Time and you're faced with a bleak, barren wasteland. You see the ring of fire around the crown, the summit of Death Mountain, and you know immediately that things are not right. To me, that's one of the biggest paradigm shifts of any video game that I've ever played. It immediately puts you on your back foot.
Yeah, look, this part of the game is why it's called Ocarina of Time. So it's a very important... very important aspect of the game. You know, it would just, I don't know what it would be called otherwise, the ocarina of music, I guess, without this part. So, but this had a huge impact on me as a child. Like, I was afraid of Hyrule Castle Town, for good reason. It's not just because I was 8, it's because they're horrifying monsters that screech at you and then you freeze and then they slowly come closer towards you, which is some of the most, you know, it's apparently not a horror game, Ocarina of Time, but when it comes when it comes to Reeds and when it comes to wall masters and floor masters and the thing under the well. I think there's some very creepy aspects to Ocarina of Time. This is just a and this just sort of has a big impact. It sort of and it really does something in general that allows, I guess, allows the characters and everything to get a bit more character to them. Because before, you know, there were characters in Ocarina of Time that you could talk to and you'd be like, oh, that person's kind of funny, but they would have one line, they would be two-dimensional. But then you sort of get this chance to say, all right, what's going to happen, you know, after the apocalypse, basically. The hero's lost, the hero wasn't there, the apocalypse happened. How are people living after this? And then you meet some of the same characters and they've got a bit more depth to them. And that's something that they continued that theme very strongly in Majora's Mask as well. But, you know, I think it is a big, something that has a big impact on gaming as a whole.
I think that's especially true whenever you make your way to Kakariko Village after you leave Castletown and you see the entire population of Castletown when you were a child, Link, who are there, and they all have something to say about, I mean, they're basically refugees, right? Things absolutely went to crap in Hyrule Castletown and they had to get out of there to survive. And now they're all just kind of, you know, Kakariko Village is a pretty full place as adult Link, just because they're housing the people who had to get away from Castletown. It's really interesting. And it does create a very off-putting sense of trauma for a lot of these characters. You know, I mean, this is one of the areas where I think that the 3D remaster gains a bit from the N64 original, because they do make Castletown look awful.
It's terrifying.
Yeah.
To your point about characters who have like obviously experienced some trauma in this whole thing, the two brothers who are near the well in when you're young Link and they're playing with the balls, they're just juggling back and forth. When you talk to them, they're now by the tree in Kakariko Village. One of them
You mean they were previously by the fountain in Castletown?
Correct.
And
yeah,
now
correct.
They're
by the tree in Kakariko Village as adult Link. The one in blue, I believe, says something along the lines of, he's been, his brother, such a coward since we left Castletown. He's not the same. And like, that's just one line that I remember very vividly from my playthrough. It was like, dang, this dude's like got some serious PTSD going on.
Well, and to Cody's point, that is the kind of thing that you could easily overlook in Ocarina of Time, but it was still shading the whole experience. But it was a thing that Nintendo took. It was a mentality that Nintendo took when they were developing Majora's Mask after this game.
Oh, for sure.
And just doubled down on it. I mean, just talking, like, putting their characters through a variety of existential traumas.
Crises.
Yeah, crises over a three-day period, you know. And it creates a very real sense of pain, you know, for a lot of these characters that are otherwise very two-dimensional. And so I think Nintendo, the entire development team behind this game is to be commended for that, because, you know, that's a layer of emotional depth that I would say you probably hadn't seen a lot of in game design up until this point.
Did you know about the god that that you can only talk to at a brief period of time before this all happens?
Yes, this is the first time I've ever met this guard, and I'm so glad that you remember this and brought it up. The first time I've ever met this guard, as you're coming into the castle, as you're coming into Castletown after your encounter with Ganondorf, before you go to the Temple of Time, you have to go into the back alley. That's if you go around by the shooting gallery and go to the left into the back alley, there is a guard who is sitting there who tried to protect Impa and Princess Zelda as they fled from Ganondorf. And he straight up talks to you, tells you to like go to the Temple of Time and that he tried to protect the princess and Impa. And then he dies. And like you try to talk to him again and it said this guard is no longer moving.
Are you serious?
I am 100% serious. I have never seen this before in any of my playthroughs. I've met this guard for the first time ever. That was intense.
I have played Ocarina of Time, at least 10 times. I mean, I've played this game a lot since I was eight. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I've ever met this guy before.
Yeah.
Seriously?
Obviously. I'm not just making this up. No. And Cody's corroborating. He's over there nodding his head. Yeah.
I believe you guys, but this is like, so I'm hearing about this now. And to me, it's like, you know, with Breath of the Wild, people are discovering a new thing in that game every week, right? It's been out for years. So, and Ocarina of Time, I never thought was that kind of game. You know, I figured I'd seen about everything there was to see in that game. But now, whenever I can go back in time again next week, because
you can't, he'll be gone. He's only available during this period of time.
You can't go back in time and find him again.
No, I don't think so.
But that's why most people don't see him, is because he's for that specific cutscene period. He's there dying and in a back alley, which most people don't remember exists in the first place, let alone, mm-hmm. let alone when there's an event happening. So yeah, he's one of the more obscure characters in Ocarina of Time. A lot of people probably have never seen him.
Hey, listen.
Hey, Editing Mike here. I just want you guys to know that I went back, did a little research. Turns out that Matt and Cody were completely right. After that section of the game, you can no longer encounter the guard in the back alley. So once you go to the future and become Adult Link, you can no longer find him in the game. It's a really, really cool exchange. And if you did miss it like me, I highly recommend you go and Google Hyrule Castle Town Back Alley Guard. I think there's a Zeldapedia article with a video at the bottom that'll show you the entire exchange. But it is seriously cool. Go check that out. Really cool part of the game that I think Cody's right. A lot of people like me just missed it, and it is worth seeing. That is excellent. I am actually very glad that you guys talked about that, because I had never heard that before. I will probably go YouTube that interaction.
You should. Pretty cool.
Just so I can experience it. So, Cody, I have a question for you. To me, Zelda games have this tendency of starting you off in a nice, safe space, and then halfway through the game, or after you've collected three mystical things or whatever, they'll warp you off to a darker place. And it's a recurring thing in Zelda games. Link to the Past did it from Light World to the Dark World. And in this game, we have that kind of moment where we go from the past to the dark future. So I guess I want to ask you, because I had some thoughts about this, do you feel like this is one of the better handled instances of that phenomenon? Because I don't necessarily think that it is.
I mean, I guess it really depends on what your criteria is. I think it's one of the most impactful in terms of just like the emotional impact of sort of going to this world and seeing how things have changed. In terms of like the mechanics of it all and everything, I think, yeah, you know, there's a few, A Link Between Worlds, you know, specifically has a whole, you know, there's Hyrule and then they've got Lorule. And, you know, there's sort of an alternate version of Zelda called Hilda and all that. And it's all very interesting on that perspective. And Zelda's had it a few times, Twilight Princess, etc. But yeah, I think this is Ocarina of Time for me as a game that it's not necessarily the smoothest in the series, but it is sort of iconic, sort of, you know, historic breakthrough in that sense.
Yeah, I agree. I think that where it excels is in that first impression of being an adult and leaving the Temple of Time. From the moment you step out of the Temple of Time and you're in Hyrule Castle Town, it is very jarring. You know, you feel, I think, exactly what they wanted you to feel. I think that a lot of that is lost as soon as you step back out into Hyrule Field. You know, one of the things that sticks with me about Link to the Past is that once you make it to the Dark World, that world is grim. The color palette is very subdued the entire time you're there. The enemies are more difficult. By the time you make it back out to Hyrule Field as an adult in Ocarina of Time, the differences have essentially ended for the most part. And in some ways, I feel like Hyrule Field as an adult is even less dangerous than it was as Child Link.
Because, that's for sure.
Because it,
there's those flying helicopter things.
Well, yeah. Around. And at night, you don't have the army of skull children.
Skull children.
Yeah, who are there anymore. So, like...
Yeah. I agree. I think... I wouldn't say it ends at Hyrule Field because... Right after that, getting into Kakiri Village Return, I think is one of the more impactful parts of the game as well. Mm-hmm. In terms of the themes of moving on and growing up, and you know, he's grown up without them. They can't grow up. They were never humans, you know, and they just don't recognize him anymore.
Yeah, I think that where the overworld lacks a developing sense of difficulty in the transition from Child to Adult Link, where you do get a lot more of that sense is just in the complexity of the game design that we go through. I think that the puzzle solving in the Adult Link sections of the game are much more complex than they were in the Child sections of the game. The amount of steps you have to go through to get from one thing to the next are more involved. So I do think that there is just a naturally imbued sense of complexity there. And that really helps sell the narrative of the darker and more difficult Hyrule when you're Adult Link.
My big note here is that as much grandeur as the Temple of Time has, when you first walk in, the sweeping the camera angle that goes around the room and the monks chanting and the beautiful stained glass windows and everything going on in there, to me pales in comparison to the introduction of the Master Sword. Like the camera close up here as it goes up the length of the blade, as Navi continues to tell you the history around the sword, and then you know, just culminating in, oh my gosh, this is the Master Sword, and then you're approaching it. It's in its own beam of light, as if it was something like out of a display in a museum.
Yeah.
This sword is the sword. Like for the entire Legend of Zelda series, right?
Yeah.
And you feel that keenly in its introduction here in Ocarina of Time, in my opinion. So that's my like big standout moment leading up to the temple is the introduction of the Master Sword.
Yeah, the way that that's framed and the way that they, you know, they make us feel encountering that and pulling it out of the pedestal for the first time, I completely agree.
I always approach that sword at a very deliberate walking pace. I don't just run up to it.
That's so weird because I don't run to it either. It feels sacrilegious.
It feels wrong. Like, it feels so wrong to run to the pedestal. I walk to the pedestal right down the middle.
Cody, do you run to the pedestal or do you walk to the pedestal?
I don't think I've ever considered that question.
We probably care too much.
We're a little weird. Yeah, we'll take it.
No doubt.
Yeah, okay. Everyone's got their video game quirks. I have a few things that I do that are just like, oh, you got to do this. But the Master Sword wasn't one. My concern with the Master Sword was I don't want to turn into an adult again because I don't want to have to deal with the re-deads. So I just hated getting out of that castle town.
Well, one thing I do have to say about that, though, is so when you become Adult Link, you lose access to about half of your items. And I 100% understand Child Link not being able to use all the items that Adult Link has because he's small. But
very small.
Small. Yeah. But also, why can Adult Link not use a stinking slingshot? Like, does he have big old sausage fingers or something? Like, what's the deal there? I don't get it.
It doesn't make sense.
Well, the slingshot's just... slingshots, according to the Zelda series, are just sort of bad bows that can't do any damage.
Yeah, or the boomerang.
If you get around to the bow, you know.
Yeah,
that's true.
I think the actual game design explanation for this is that they didn't want you to have any kind of projectile weapon to solve any forest temple puzzles before you got the bow. So yes. Anyway,
I think that's fair.
Yeah. So anywho, we go to Kakariko Village. We acquire the hookshot. There's a little bit of a quest that we have to do here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that me, for one, I find that this is all much better explained in game than some of the past stuff we've had to do, you know, i.e. getting Saria's song to, have Darunia give us the Goron's bracelet, or feeding a fish to Jabu Jabu, or whatever. You know, I feel like this was pretty plainly telegraphed. Sheik tells us to go to Kakariko Village if we want to get into the Forest Temple. And when hearing that, you know, okay, I can't really progress until I've explored every nook and cranny in Kakariko Village.
Right.
Yeah. So that's good, and I really appreciate it. Once we do get back around to the Lost Woods, I think that it does a very good job of selling us on a sense of danger that wasn't there when we were Child Link.
Mm-hmm.
The Moblins are
terrifying.
They are beefy. They are big, chonky dudes who are there to kill you.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, so when I re-entered Kakariko Village, Forest and the village therein, right, that we grew up in, I had honestly forgotten that it was completely infested with monsters. And I was like, oh, dang, I wonder where all the Kokiri children are. And they're just like chilling in their houses or in their shops. And I'm like, and they're like, we haven't left the house in years because of the monsters. And I was like, well, I can relate, man. That sucks.
Yeah, we're all living there right now.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
Haven't left the house in years. Or at least a year.
Yeah. So yeah, that was to me, like, if I were Link, and I'm trying to like put myself in obviously Link's shoes, which is more difficult because he's not a voiced character with any voice lines at all, but like, you know, just thinking about going back to my childhood home and it being more or less, you'd have to imagine, like, it's more or less gone, right? Like,
yeah,
it's infested with evil things that are trying to kill you. And all of your friends that you grew up with are hiding and they're different. And like, man, that must have been more traumatic and challenging for him and for Navi. Or Navi, as I prefer to call her, than even Hyrule Castle Town.
And I think nowhere is that more evident than on your approach to the Forest Temple, where you have to get past King Moblin, who is a scary looking dude who nevertheless is far too big to turn around in that little canyon that he's in. I mean, he's just kind of wedged in there. So
yeah, he did that to himself.
Yeah. I like to imagine that King Moblin kind of got up to that little stairway and just kind of backed himself in there, you know, just kind of scooted backwards, mm-hmm. reversed in, and then just couldn't turn around. So it's like, okay, well,
now I'm stuck here.
Yeah. If anyone gets past me, then I guess that's all bad. Over. Yeah. So, which we did. We did that. We kicked his ass. He's done for.
He's dead ski.
So, okay. That takes us about to the Forest Temple.
Yeah, and the lead in, apart from that, it'll be interesting talking to Saria, who, if you remember, gave you an ocarina when you were first leaving, which you threw out somewhere, like into a lake or something.
Yeah, I just kind of like ditched Saria's ocarina for the new magical one.
So it's fine. You just have an awkward conversation there, and it's just awkward conversations there. About why her gift has been replaced with a better gift from another girl. But he'll have to have that conversation on his own. So,
okay, cool. That is going to take us into part three, which is the dungeon map, where we analyze this week's dungeon from mechanics to music and more. Guys, the Forest Temple is a certified 10 out of 10. It is such a crazy good dungeon, and I cannot wait.
Yeah, I can't argue that.
To talk about it. It's seriously so good. This is the spookiest forest house for art lovers. It's just, I mean, some big art connoisseur just lived in this house.
A lot of paintings.
Yeah, lived in this house for years. Was probably a great house. I think he died there, maybe with all his sisters, and now it's haunted and full of his art. So that's that's my headcanon for this whole thing. But regardless, it's a great atmosphere. It's a great dungeon. Matt, give us a few of your thoughts on the Forest Temple real quick.
Yeah, so I think what I love about the Forest, this iteration of the Forest Temple, right, is it breaks from most traditional renditions of any Forest Temple ever, right? Most Forest Temples are going to be like, oh, you're in a big tree or you're in some woods and there's a lot of like vines and all these other things. But this one's like, nah, dude, you're in a mansion in the middle of the forest. And it's super haunted, like just totally is very different than anything you ever really experienced.
Gotta call in Luigi for that kind of job.
That's exactly what I thought of. Like, oh my gosh, I'm so glad you said that because I was like, this feels like Luigi's Mansion Zelda style. So like cooler, in my opinion. I'm not a huge like Mario fan personally, but like this was like, man. Spooky, and I love it, and it's awesome.
Yeah, who
also
needs
this house had to have been super dope. Who in
needs
its prime.
Who needs a bow and arrow when you can just vacuum up those ghosts? You know, Cody, go ahead and tell us what some of your big impressions were of this temple as you remember it.
So, look, I think for me, the just the haunted mansion vibe is definitely there, complete with like. Twisting hallways that don't make sense to physics and all of that sort of thing. Skeletons and wolves and an enemy that I'd shout out specifically is the introduction of floor masters. We've had wall masters up until now, but the floor masters are here now. And these are some of the enemies that gave me the most stress. Playing this game because it's
they will kill you.
Those things are terrifying.
So Cody, I've been talking about this the last few weeks we've been recording. I'm actually playing through Ocarina of Time on a 3-heart no death run at the moment, which I think some people wouldn't consider that very challenging, but I have a hard time with it, and I really enjoy it. So the Forest Temple is one of the first points in the game where that becomes very difficult for me because one, the floor master, if you let one of those little grabby hands get you with 3 hearts, you're
dead.
You're about done. But then not only the floor masters, but this is the first time in the game where we end up fighting the Stalfos.
Mm-hmm.
And I maintain that
especially the paired Stalfos.
Well, yeah, but I maintain that the Stalfos are the best designed enemy in The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time. The way that you have to time your attacks, the way that you have to anticipate them attacking you, the AI of those enemies is very aggressive compared to a lot of the other people that you fight. And they will wreck your world. I mean, having to parry at just the right times, being able to anticipate their jump attacks, which just like Link's jump attack, do double damage.
Mm-hmm.
They're very ferocious enemies, and I've attempted 3-heart no death runs in Ocarina of Time before, and the Stalfos are almost always the enemies that kind of end up getting me in the end. Because with the wall masters or the floor masters, you can break them down into the little grabby hands, and then you can pop Den's fire, and then they're all dead or something, But
I love Den's fire.
But with Stalfos, you actually have to put thought into it. Like you have to fight those guys. You have to very intentionally parry their attacks and all that. So anyway, Stalfos, great enemies. They appear several times in this dungeon.
Three times.
Yeah, it starts off easy enough. You only have to kill two of them. In order to get the bow, you have to kill two of them in a certain amount of time, because if you go too long after defeating the first one, he comes back to life and you're fighting two again. Yeah. It really puts the pressure on you.
Yeah, so I think like another... So I guess we'll get into the Matt's confession time here of the part that I got stumped on. Not necessarily stumped. I got stuck.
This is an addendum to the Sacred Realms rundown. This addendum shall be titled "The Part Where Matt Had to Use the Guide." So let's get into that.
So I got the bow. I was progressing through. I shot the eye to make the first hallway you come across that's wonky. I shot the eye to make it straight where you get the boss key from. So I went and got the boss key, but I hadn't gone to the third Poe sister yet. I hadn't done the green post sister at that point. And if you make that hallway straight, you cannot progress back to the third post sister. So I was stuck with a small key and I couldn't get to any, I couldn't progress past anything that I've already done. I spent probably an hour going back through every single portion of the forest temple ad nauseum, trying to like bomb walls, play the Song of Storms, look for anything I could hookshot onto. And then I finally was so stumped that I was like, okay, what do I do? And it came across, I was like, oh, you can shoot that silver diamond eye again to make the hallway crooked. And that's how you get back through to the green sister. So I had to go back through, reshoot the eye, make the hallway crooked. Now that I had the boss key, go all the way through to the green post sister and kill her that way.
Yeah, that definitely speaks very much to an element of what I think makes adult Link dungeons more difficult than child Link dungeons, which is that there's a very intentional amount of backtracking that has to happen, where it's not just enough to go from room to room to room and solve puzzle to puzzle to puzzle. You have to actually go back through the dungeon where you've already been and try to see if there are any new ways to interact with it based on new items that you have. Mm-hmm. And that's one of those moments, you know?
And like, I forgot completely that you can shoot the silver eyes. You can't shoot the gold eyes twice. You can shoot the silver eyes twice. Or like, you know, to make them open and close at will.
Yeah.
And like, I had completely forgotten that. And so when it was like, oh, you can shoot the silver eye to make the hallway crooked or straight based on what you need. And I was like, oh my God, I'm such an idiot. That's exactly what I was missing.
Yeah. I think it definitely is a step up in difficulty starting now with the dungeons. Previously, you know, there were some good dungeons, but you could muddle your way through it. To an extent, getting into these dungeons, you've still got the most infamous candidate coming up for dungeons that you have to keep track of what's going on in the whole thing, the Water Temple. So, you know, that's going to be a fun time. But I think you do see the start of all that here in the Forest Temple.
Yeah, definitely. And this is just a reminder for everybody listening, our Water Temple episode is going to be awesome. We have got a game designer from a
AAA studio,
a very well-known AAA studio, who's going to be on with us to talk about, from a game design perspective, why the Water Temple is so infamous. So that's going to be fun. But Cody is absolutely right. The seeds of that level of difficulty are planted starting here. I would say that there is a massive gap in difficulty and critical thinking required from Jabu Jabu's belly to this dungeon.
For sure.
Yeah, there's a lot more thinking that you have to do. This is the first dungeon in the game where we actually have small keys. We did not have those in any of the child dungeons. They're present here for the first time, which means that the compass is actually useful for once we get here, because the compass is only good for encountering chests. And in the child Link dungeons, like, what chests are you going to miss, really, you know? But anyway, we get here, we've got small keys, and that's a whole other mechanic to puzzle solving in the dungeon. And that's where I have found that a lot of backtracking and a lot of confusion happens in these adult Link dungeons, is when you get to a door and you don't have a key. And you're thinking like, oh crap, where did I go wrong? You know?
Mm-hmm. What did I miss?
Yeah. So And that's great. And, you know, this is not a recent game. As we said previously, this game is going on 25 years old, but this is still a very challenging game design sensibility. Yeah. And I love it.
And I want to kind of move forward here with this is also the first dungeon we've had where you don't have like a true mini boss. I mean, maybe besides the Great Deku Tree, where you have the four Poe sisters who are kind of like spread throughout the whole dungeon, which I think is a fantastic mechanic. And using the bow, which, by the way, the fairy bow may be my favorite Zelda item. I love the bow and arrow in every Zelda game it's in. My biggest qualm with Skyward Sword, which is, as I've said before, my favorite Zelda game. My biggest qualm with Skyward Sword is that you get the bow almost at the very end of the game, which annoys me. I love the fairy bow. And I love that you have to fight these three Poe sisters. They're not hard fights at all. You know, once you kind of get the hang of shoot them, make them go invisible, wait for them to come visible, shoot them again, rinse and repeat, blah, blah, blah. The fourth Poe sister being the one that replicates herself and you have to shoot the right one. Super fun. Like, I just think that it's a very interesting, well done, well thought out mixture on the classic Zelda dungeon formula. Very, so very good.
Hey, Cody, I know you know the answer to this question, but just for the sake of our listeners, do you know how to distinguish the correct Poe to shoot when you're fighting the purple Poe sister and she replicates herself? How do you tell which one is the right one to shoot?
Oh, I do know this, but I'm just I'm just trying to remember because it has been a couple of years since I last played it. What was it?
She spins around.
Yep. When they replicate, she does a little pirouette.
Yeah.
Which is fun.
Yeah. And speaking of the difficulty, actually, have either of you played Master Quest before?
No,
I have. I have done Ocarina of Time Master Quest.
Yeah, that's a, if you want a bit more difficulty added to your three hearts run, you can always mm-hmm. add a few cows to the mix. Something to consider for those of you who've played Ocarina of Time before and you want something sort of messing it up a bit, you know. I would also recommend randomizers, which are very popular these days. The Ocarina of Time randomizer is a popular one where just you open a chest, you have no idea which item's in it. So you just have to wander around being like, I need to figure out how to actually get to the next thing because the hookshot is in some like random treasure chest somewhere.
That sounds incredibly painful.
Yeah, no kidding.
I remember when I played the Master Quest version, and I actually thought about doing the Master Quest version for this podcast, but figured we should probably all be playing the same version at the very least, because the Master Quest is a little bit different some places. But Master Quest is very fun. I actually also very much enjoy the Skyward Sword Master Quest, which just really, I think the main thing there is that it just ups the difficulty by a lot of, you know, how much damage you take versus give. So yeah, Master Quest is a phenomenal game type.
So before we move on from this section, I do want to talk about the boss fight real quick, because mm-hmm. Phantom Ganon, I think, is one of the better bosses in the entire game.
Yes, totally agree.
I think there's a case to be made for Phantom Ganon being harder than Ganondorf.
I think Phantom Ganon is much harder than Ganondorf.
When you play him later.
Personally.
But Cody, where are you at with this? I mean, what do you think of Phantom Ganon as a boss?
I think Phantom Ganon is... I think Phantom Ganon is quite good. We had a charity marathon that we do every year of playing through the Zelda games, and they got really stuck on this boss for a while because they were playing the like emulated Wii. It's either Wii or Wii U version, which has like a lag.
Gross. Yes,
it has this lag, and they could not just like turn around and shoot Phantom Ganon in time.
The proper painting.
It's a bit of a nightmare. But I think, you know, this is definitely it's a really interesting theme, I think, for a boss, with all the paintings and everything. It sort of fits with all the, you know, the whole painting situation that's been going on throughout where you're shooting them to deal with bows and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It would definitely be up there in boss fights for me in Ocarina of Time. I think Ganondorf would probably be... Ganondorf's very memorable, but not necessarily in terms of difficulty, who I would put right up at the top there. So,
Yeah. With Phantom Ganon, you have that random factor where you're trying to figure out which painting he's coming from and also trying to pick the right one, you know?
Yeah, because at one point he's coming out of multiple until the last second when one turns around and then you have to find the other one and you're like, oh, God, which one is it?
So that creates a very frantic tone for this boss fight. I mean, the actual like tennis ball thing, once his horse is dead and you're just tennis balling the energy back and forth,
it's no problem.
It's fun, but it's not the hardest thing in the world. But you can get just completely rolled by this boss if you're picking the wrong painting to try and shoot with an arrow, you know?
Yes.
Over and over and over again. Cody, it's really funny that you mentioned the Wii U gamepad lag because have you heard of Kylie Parker before, Captain Dangerous? I'm sure you've seen her work online.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So she was on two episodes ago, and that was our Dodongo's Cavern episode. And she was telling us this great story about how she got absolutely demolished by King Dodongo at one point. And Matt and I are looking at each other like, how does that happen? And she was like, no, you guys have to understand. I was playing on the Wii U gamepad with about a 0.5 milliseconds of lag between what I was doing and what the game was actually reading. And so I switched to the Wii U Pro controller and that completely made the difference. But it's just so funny because what you were talking about is the second instance of don't play this game on the Wii U, you know, gamepad that we've had on the show so far,
which is hilarious.
Yeah.
And it's funny also that you mentioned they had such a hard time of switching between the paintings. One of my big complaint with this boss fight was the 3DS joystick is so slow with aiming. Like, I'm not using the motion controls on the 3DS. Like, switching between painting to painting just feels like it takes forever when you're using just the thumbstick.
I'm a big fan of the gyro controls for the bow. I think it's a huge upgrade from the N64 version where you're sort of manually trying to... I'm making gestures with my hands. I don't think people will be able to see that.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Because I think it makes a few things much easier. I always struggled with, like, the bow shooting mini games and that sort of thing in the original, just because it was a little wonky. But I thought by the time when you get around to the gyro controls, it is actually, if it works for you, I think it's much smoother.
So you and I are of a mind about this, Cody. I really enjoy the gyro controls. I've never had a problem with them.
I hate them.
Yeah. So we're a house divided on this issue, but I personally love them quite a lot. But anyway, that has been part three of the dungeon map. Honestly, just to put a final word on the Forest Temple, I think that it has got one of the best tones and aesthetics of a Zelda dungeon in any game that I played. If you asked me to rank my top five Zelda dungeons of all time, I think the Forest Temple would be on that list somewhere for me. It's excellent. Matt, what do you have?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think this is my second favorite dungeon in this game, which is a high bar. Like, I think Ocarina of Time has the best dungeons, in my opinion. Like,
what's your first favorite?
Spirit Temple.
Oh, okay. Can't wait to get there.
I love the Spirit Temple. But we'll get there, as you said, at some point. But the Forest Temple, the music, the ambiance, the haunted house vibe, the boss fight, the fairy bow, all of the above just like come together in such a special way to make such a fantastic dungeon. One that is so easy to remember even when you haven't played the game for like 5 or 6 years. You look back and you say, man, I remember that haunted mansion that is the Forest Temple, and that was super fun.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. This is part four, which is where we talk side quests. And Matt, I want you to run down real quick what side quests you played in this section of the game. I did not tackle any side quests. I just did the mainline stuff this week, so this is going to be mostly you. But Cody was sounding like he had something to say about the Epona section later, so I feel like you guys are going to be tag-teaming that. But Matt, you go first, and then you guys can talk about Epona here in just a second.
Yeah, so I... While Lyndon is doing his three heart no death run, I have decided to do a 100% completion playthrough myself. That includes all the major points. I'm not going to literally open every chest in the game, just all the gold sculptulas, all the side quests, et cetera, et cetera.
All the heart pieces.
Yes, all the heart pieces. So I got 43 gold sculptula tokens now as Young Link. I got every gold sculptula token in the game that you can get as Young Link after you have the boomerang. I rescued Epona, which Cody and I will discuss shortly. I got the Song of Storms, and I got 4 or 5 heart pieces in addition. Because I got all 43 gold Scotula tokens, I also got the Shard of Agony and the Giant's Wallet. So, lots of stuff going on there. Oh, I beat the Bomb Chew Alley game finally. Dave the Giant Chicken did not best me this time. And I completed the Mask Trading side quest. So
Dave the Giant Chicken let you win.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that because he was really starting to get on my nerves. And the last thing I did before going to get the Master Sword was complete the Mask Trading quest. So Marathon Man has his bunny hood now, and I have the Mask of Truth, which is fun. So I did a lot of side quests. My favorite one by far is rescuing Epona from that jackass Inigo. Ingo? Which one is it? I think it's Inigo.
It's Ingo.
Ingo. Whatever. Ingo. He is the worst, and I was so happy to rescue Epona from him, and I remember doing it like it was the back of my hand. I beat him in 2 races back-to-back. He never even had a chance. So that was a lot of fun. But to your point earlier, Cody, I distinctly remember as a child, after I finally beat Ingo, I could not get out of Lon Lon Ranch to save my life. How did you get out of there eventually? I had to ask Lyndon to help me to get out because like I just couldn't get out. And so I was like, Lyndon, because I was 5 at the time. How do I get out of here?
I think I must have looked it up or something because I sort of just, I had no idea what to do. It's definitely one where you have to think for yourself there. And it just didn't occur to me for a while. But yeah, I think this is an area of the game that's quite fun, where Luigi has taken over the ranch, has kicked out Mario. there's definitely a Mario and Luigi intent sort of here with these characters. You've sort of got the tall one living under the shadow of the other more successful one who gets his revenge. So sort of like evil Luigi here. And of course you meet Malin again, who for those who were involved in the Ocarina of Time fan community back in the day, this was the big shipping split was yes. Whether Link should be with Zelda or whether Link should be with Malin. Or whether Link should be with Rudo, but those people, don't worry about them. They're up to something. Malin, of course, the canonical choice. As we know in Twilight Princess, Link has grown up on a ranch. So I guess that shows what happened there. That's not confirmed, but that is something that people have noted. But yeah, I think this is an interesting side quest. I do like the horse riding mini games, or just the racing basically. And it is fun to sort of see the benefits of going forward in time 7 years.
Yeah, for sure. And I think actually it's interesting you say that it's Twilight Princess Link is stated canonically in the game to be a direct descendant of the Hero of Time. The fact that he would then logically be a descendant of Link and Malin instead of Link and Zelda makes a lot of sense, and I had actually never considered that before at all. So that's cool. That'll give a whole new light to when we play Twilight Princess next.
Yep, no kidding. Okay, so I'm going to move us right along. That has been part four, where we talk about side quests. Again, I did not a single side quest this week, so we'll get back to that.
Boring.
I know. Well, there's a sense of urgency in this part of the game where you go into the future and everyone's just like, go here, do this thing, go save this person, go, you know, like, true. Yeah. Okay. So I can only imagine that I will front load my next section of the game with taking care of a few side questy bits, including freeing Epona from Lon Lon Ranch and a few other things.
So, well, that's fair.
Yeah, so all fun there. Let's get into part five real quick, which is Z targeting, where we lock on to fascinating characters or enemies that we happen to cross. We're each going to go with one pick. I'm going to go ahead and start. I was a big fan of Dompe, the undead grave digger, in this section of the game. I just, you know, he's there to have a good time, but also help out. You know, he has his life's treasure, which is the hook shot. He's happy to give it to you as long as you race him. And, you know, I just like his attitude. He's a lot of fun. I also really enjoy his character design, which is just floating Dompe with a little halo over his head. It's just very on the nose, right?
Like, yeah.
I mean, if he was just floating, it would have been enough to be like, oh, there's something supernatural going on here. But he also has a halo. So, okay, yeah, he's dead. And apparently he was a pretty good guy, I guess. So, yeah, that's the Dompe the Grave Digger. One of Zelda, the Legend of Zelda's recurring characters who has a lot of personality wherever he crops up. So I enjoy him quite a lot. Cody, give us the rundown on one of your favorite characters from this section of the game.
All right. So I've sort of been mentioning a few characters throughout, Saria and Malin and Sheik and all that, but I'm going to go with a character from an optional side quest that you can do after turning into Adult Link. His name is Guru Guru, and he wants to teach you the Song of Storms and the Windmill. Or as far as who wants to teach who the Song of Storms, that's a very complicated timeline discussion.
You're right.
Somebody teaches somebody else the Song of Storms, who teaches it to the person who originally taught it to them.
Which came first, the chicken or the egg?
Yeah, but Song of Storms, just sort of shout out Song of Storms as a fantastic song in the Ocarina of Time soundtrack. And it is a side quest that you can go ahead and it is on the way in Kakariko. And that's just a really fun character. He's got his bald with his little beard, and he's very intense. Great character.
Cool. That's a great choice. Matt, who is yours?
So mine is actually, I'm going to change it here. I had originally had one, but I'm going to pick a different one. It's Milo.
Mido.
Mido. Why do I'm so bad at these names, man?
I don't know. You should read them harder.
I guess so. Mido. Mido, I originally very much disliked.
We stole his entire life savings.
Well, yeah, it was like 6 rupees.
He worked real hard for that 6 rupees, man.
he's a child.
I mean, that's a good point.
And like adjusting for inflation between child link timeline and adult link timeline, that 6 rupees might have been. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Economics.
Uh-huh.
I'm an artist. You shouldn't listen to anything I'm saying right now.
Uh-huh. So anyway, Mido, who I originally very much disliked, the fact that he is spending basically, they're immortal, more or less, forest spirits, right? Who like don't age or die.
Yep.
He's spending his immortal life guarding the entrance to the Sacred Forest Meadow to protect his friend. Like, man, okay, I can get on board with that. Like, you're kind of a cool dude in my book now. And he's protecting this entrance with no weapons, no shield, no nothing, just his spunky attitude. And I can't get on board with that, man. Like, I appreciate you, Mido. You be you.
Yeah, I have this listed in my notes. It says, Mido, still not wonderful, but also not terrible.
That's pretty much exactly where I'm landing here. Yeah. The fact that he lets you buy once you play Saria's song. I'm like, okay, dude. Like, and he mentions like, oh, you remind me of that boy from, you know, my long ago, blah, blah, blah. Like, okay. Like, okay. We're having a moment, like a little bit of a moment here. I appreciate it. Yeah.
I think in general, there's a very interesting sort of, well, I think Peter Pan is probably the most obvious, not just because they dress like Peter Pan, but because they're a village of children that never grow up. Right. I think they're an interesting sort of species there to look at, and just sort of the whole situation with Saria, but also with Mido, and how he, you know, is still thinking about you.
That has been part 5, Z Targeting, where we talk about characters that we found interesting. Let's get into our final part here, which is part 6, our final thoughts. Matt, give us a sentence or two. You can do one sentence with a semicolon in the middle is appropriate if that's what you're feeling. I don't know. Just put a cap on things for us.
So I think this is what this section of the game is what makes Ocarina of Time one of the most iconic entrances in the Zelda franchise. The going from young Link to adult Link, the change, what, the 180 degree change in tone, the sense of urgency, and being adult Link, which I think this is the first time you really are ever an adult as Link.
Well, it's the first time that there are graphics good enough to support, you know, you being able to tell one way or the other.
So like this section of the game, in my opinion, is what solidifies even more so than just the 3D graphics, Ocarina of Time as a very special entry in the Legend of Zelda franchise. And that's just further capitalized by the Forest Temple being such an amazing temple.
Cool. I would say that this section of the game was one of the most fun to play through so far. The Forest Temple, 100% a standout. It was a great time. I enjoyed it thoroughly, from its mechanics to its music and its atmosphere to its boss. It was a great, great temple. And just in general, I agree with you that the switch in tone from Child Link to Adult Link, while could have been borne out a little bit more in just sheer difficulty of the overworld, as in past games, that's neither here nor there. I think it's still successful. So very, very pleased with it. Cody, do you want to give us a little cap sentence? You know, tell us just a very brief finishing thought on this section of the game.
Yeah, look, I think this is where Ocarina of Time really distinguishes itself. As you know, because a lot of people compare this game to A Link to the Past for good reason. It sort of follows the same general format. You know, you do the original three things or whatever, and you reach a point and then you unlock some later part of the game, etc. But I think this is where you really start to see Ocarina of Time as its own game start to experiment with really interesting concepts. And, you know, clearly it's something that conceptually all of this time travel stuff has had a huge impact on the Zelda fandom when it comes to things like the timeline, which it only got confirmed in, you know, Hyrule Historia book. But there's been theories about the timeline thanks to Ocarina of Time for ever since it came out. People have been arguing, is it a linear timeline? Is it a split timeline? You know, what's happening with all of this. So I think that's something that's really, it's really fascinating when you look at it, just looking at the impact that it's had in that sense as well.
Yep, I think you said it better than either Matthew or I did. So well done. Ladies and gentlemen, that has been the Sacred Realms Rundown. We will be back next week with another section of Sacred Realms Rundown, talking about a completely different section of the game. But this one has been a lot of fun. Obviously, lots to dig into here. This show, just in general, is running kind of long. So we had a listener mail for today. I think we're probably going to push that one back to next week and get to it then, just because we have had so much to talk about today. But we will get to another listener mail next week. Just a reminder, please, if you are a patron, or if you would like to write in and you have a question for us, head over to patreon.com/sacredrealmspod and you can write in with your listener mail and we will read it here on the show and dig into exactly whatever you have for us. So until next time, I actually, real quick, I do want to give Cody one more second of spotlight just to tell us where we can follow you, where we can keep up with what you're doing, you know.
Yeah, well, you can keep up with Zelda Universe by going to ZeldaUniverse.net or visiting, as I mentioned, our TikTok or our various other useful things that we do to keep up with the kids these days. You can follow me. I'm on Twitter at Magicody. That's M-A-G-I-C-O-D-Y. And, you know, I do tweet occasionally and... Yeah, happy to be here. It's good to talk to you.
Cody, we are really, really thankful for you coming on and agreeing to take a chunk out of your weekend to, well, actually, it's still Sunday there, right? Or is it Monday now?
It is Monday afternoon.
Oh my gosh, you're in the future. how is the future,
Cody?
Sorry, the
people listening to this, it will be even further in the future, potentially.
Yeah, right. Okay, true. Cool. Well, regardless, we appreciate you taking a chunk out of your day to talk to us about this. You know, we all love talking about Zelda, and I think that's very evident from this whole conversation. We've covered a lot of ground here, so really, really appreciate that. For everybody listening to today's show, if you enjoyed it and you would like a little extra Sacred Realms in your life, please head over to patreon.com/sacredrealmspod where you can become a patron. If you got no rupees, it isn't a problem. 5-star Apple Podcast reviews or wherever you get your podcasts are a great free way to support us. More reviews means that more people see our show, and that makes us very, very happy Hylians. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Sacred Realms Pod for updates on the pod and for behind the scenes action. Sacred Realms will be back next Wednesday with our thoughts on Ocarina of Time from right after we beat the Forest Temple through beating the Fire Temple. And we will once again have a guest on that show, and that is going to be Nintendo fangirl Sam O'Neill. She's committed to being on that episode, and we are so excited to talk to her about that section of the game. So that's going to be a great, great one. We would love for you to play along with us as we're going through this journey. Share your thoughts with us on our social channels. Ocarina of Time can be played on the Nintendo 3DS or 2DS, or you could always break out your trusty N64. As some have mentioned on the show, you can play it on the Wii U gamepad via the virtual console if you would like, but
we wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah, the general consensus seems to be don't do that. So yeah, steer clear. But in the meantime, may your hearts be full and may your arrows never miss. We will catch you guys next time. Sacred Realms is an independent podcast production which is produced, edited, and mixed by me, Lyndon Willoughby. Our music comes from Zelda and Chill by Mikkel and is graciously provided to us by Mikkel and Game Chops Records. Zelda and Chill is available to stream on Spotify or to purchase directly from GameChops.com. Finally, our thanks go to Nintendo for creating such exceptional and innovative experiences.